Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals afternoon session. We have two cases on our docket for oral argument today, and I will introduce the justices on our panel for those who have not been here before. Justice Lee Gabriel on my left, Justice Bill Meyer on my right, and I'm Justice Ann Gardner. And again, welcome. I believe someone is here from Houston. Okay. And Dallas. Okay. That's great. Well, I will ask the clerk to call the case, the first case that's scheduled for oral argument. Okay, Ms. Auld, proceed.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Marianne Auld, and I am here representing today BNSF Railway Company in this appeal from a judgment that the trial court entered in favor of the appellee, Ms. Stacy Wipf, under the FELA, the Federal Employers Liability Act, and the doctrine of respondeat superior. With me at council table is Jody Sanders and also Lynn Robbins, who is a senior attorney with BNSF. By way of a brief background, this case involves an incident in which Robert Deal, an engineer for BNSF, intentionally mishandled a train on which Ms. Wipf was working as a conductor, and it injured Ms. Wipf's back. Although Ms. Wipf continued to work for a couple of weeks following the incident, she ultimately took some time off to get some medical attention, and despite BNSF's attempts to get her another job that she could work, she never returned to work at BNSF. Ultimately, she had two surgeries on her back. The first was in December of 2009. Her surgeon, Dr. Wharton, who later became her medical expert in this case, used bone grafts and bone screws to repair the injuries to her back. Because she continued to experience pain from that, there was a second surgery in May of 2011 in which the hardware was replaced, and fortunately, that worked. According to Dr. Wharton's records, about a month after the surgery, he made a notation that while she still had some soreness, Ms. Wipf, her pain that she had had before surgery was resolved. When this case was tried in January of 2012, the jury returned a verdict 11-1 in favor of Ms. Wipf, and the trial court, Judge Wallace, entered a judgment for approximately $2.7 million. $1 million of that was for future physical pain and mental anguish. The trial court's judgment should be reversed for three reasons. First, the trial court erred in denying BNSF's timely jury shuffle demand. Second, the judgment awarding Ms. Wipf $1 million in future physical pain and mental anguish was not supported by legally sufficient evidence, and alternatively, it is excessive. Third, the trial court's exclusion of Ms. Wipf's counseling records and BNSF's salary advancements deprived BNSF of a full and fair opportunity to cross-examine Ms. Wipf. Turning to the jury shuffle issue, under a de novo standard of review, this court should reverse the trial court's judgment and order a new trial because BNSF made a timely shuffle demand that the trial court had no discretion to deny. Specifically, Rule 2...
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Excuse me. I thought that there was some conflict or confusion over whether the jury had been sworn when the demand was made, and I would like for you to address that fact if it's shown in the record.
Okay. There is some conflict about that. There are two rules that require the trial court to take certain actions before voir dire begins, before the examination begins. One is Rule 226, which requires the trial court to swear the panel, give them an oath, in other words, before voir dire begins. And the other is Rule 226A, which provides that the court must give instructions to the jury panel as prescribed by the Supreme Court under this rule. And then those rules are spelled out in Rule 226A. It says exactly what has to happen before examination. And specifically, it says the approved instructions say that the following oral instructions shall be given by the court to the members of the jury panel after they have been sworn in as provided in Rule 226 and before the voir dire examination. In this case, from our record, it is not clear whether and when the juror panel was given their oath under Rule 226. That's what you've seen the motions between the parties on, where there was an attempt by the appellee to supplement the record with an affidavit that says that this is the process that is followed, is that the jurors are given the oath when they're in the central jury room, filling out their juror cards, and if there's a questionnaire, those questionnaires. The record is not clear on that, and frankly, even the affidavit doesn't make it clear whether the jurors in this case were actually given that oath. There is no discrepancy, no misunderstanding about when the admonitory instructions required by Rule 226A were given. Those were given after the demand for the shuffle was denied. They were supposed to be given before voir dire examination begins. In this case, Judge Wallace determined that voir dire had begun at the point in time when the questionnaires were filled out and the lawyers saw the answers to those questionnaires, but that really, as a matter of law, cannot be so because Rule 226A requires, before the beginning of the voir dire examination, for the 226A admonitory instructions to be given. So that's the discrepancy. Two separate oaths, unclear on one, very clear on the other. When you apply the rules, 223, which is the jury shuffle rule, 226, which is the juror oath, and 226A, which deals with the admonitory instructions that were not given here until the demand had already been denied, you can see that, in fact, BNSF's request or demand for a shuffle was, in fact, timely. On the Friday before trial, this was in January of 2012, January 6th, there was a Friday, the parties were here for a pretrial hearing. The juror panel was down in the central jury room filling out cards and questionnaires. While the proceeding was going on in the courtroom with Judge Wallace, it was clear that the panel members were down filling out their information. But it's also clear that the lawyers, the parties, did not ever see the jurors that day, nor did they get any of the juror information while they were here at the courthouse that day. Instead, once everyone had finished up for the day, everyone left. Ms. Whipp's lawyers provided copies of the questionnaires to the lawyers for BNSF, who then went back to their office and continued to prepare for trial. At that time, they did not look at the questionnaires. So this is Friday afternoon before trial on Monday. At about 4:15 in the afternoon, the court coordinator for Judge Wallace's court sends the juror cards to the lawyers. Some short time after that, the lawyer for BNSF looked at the juror cards and on that basis made a decision, I'm going to ask for a jury shuffle. It's now, though, after hours on Friday. There is no meaningful way to assert a right to a shuffle. So she made the determination to do that on Monday morning. And sure enough, first thing Monday morning, the day the trial was to begin, she went into the courtroom, very first thing, demanded a shuffle. That shuffle was denied, despite the fact that it's undisputed on the record. Volume 3, page 12, demonstrates that the admonitory instructions that are required to be given before voir dire had not been given. Now, Judge Wallace denied the shuffle demand on the basis of this court's opinion in Carr versus Smith. Carr but is readily distinguishable from this case, however, and thus it really should not control the outcome here. In Carr, the jury panel had been segregated in the central jury room. The jury panel had been sworn under Rule 226. The parties had viewed the jury panel in their seated order, and they had actually had the juror information cards with them at the time that they were viewing the jury panel in its seated order. What that means is that the parties and their counsel had everything at that time while they were there in the courthouse that day to demand a jury shuffle. The circumstances in this case are far different. Although it does appear that the jury panel was segregated so that they could fill out their juror cards and questionnaires, as I mentioned earlier in response to your question, Justice Gardner, it's unclear whether they had been given the oath under Rule 226 The record's absolutely clear, though, that the jury panel had not been given the admonitory instructions that Rule 226A requires be given before voir dire begins. Further, at the time that BNSF made its demand, the parties had not yet seen the jury panel, much less seen the jury panel in its seated order. And finally, counsel for the parties did not receive the juror cards and the questionnaires until after they had left the courthouse on the Friday before trial. So they never had an opportunity to demand a jury shuffle before they came into court on Monday morning, the day the trial was to begin. Perhaps the most significant difference between this case and Carr is in the fact that Carr involved the trial court's grant of a jury shuffle demand rather than here. Here, the trial court denied a jury shuffle demand. Well, why is that important? That's important because when the trial court denies a timely demand, as it did here, it has automatically violated a mandatory rule. It has a mandatory duty to grant a timely shuffle, and harm is going to result from the failure to do that. What kind of harm? Well, the party that is demanding the shuffle is harmed first by the fact that the demand has been denied, and second, by the fact that that party may not then properly present any error to the Court of Appeals. In other words, by improperly denying a timely shuffle demand, a trial court necessarily commits harmful error. For these reasons, this court should presume harm from the trial court's erroneous denial of BNSF's timely shuffle demand.
Their argument that you're not harmed unless you can show that the original panel was not randomly selected or that you had to take someone on the jury that was objectionable to you?
Yes, Justice Gabriel, I think that is their argument. However, that really is an impossibility. When the shuffle has not been conducted, it is virtually impossible. It is practically impossible to show the error that Ms. Whipp's counsel has said we ought to have to show. And let me explain why I don't think that that's proper here. Rule 223 is a mandatory rule. In other words, it creates a mandatory duty. The court shall grant the shuffle. In this context, when Texas courts are dealing with mandatory duties, they consistently apply a presumed harm analysis. For example, in the Churn Industries case, the Texas Supreme Court presumed harm when the trial court failed to comply with a mandatory duty to file findings and conclusions. Similarly, in the Neiman case, the Eastland Court of Appeals applied presumed harm when the trial court failed to comply with a mandatory duty that dealt with a de novo hearing and whether or not to conduct this hearing. He had a duty to do it. It was presumed harm when he didn't. Most significantly, the Supreme Court has applied a presumed harm analysis in another setting involving jury selection. That's the Cortez case from 2005. Let me briefly describe Cortez because I think it's completely appropriate here. Plaintiff's counsel in that case unsuccessfully attempted to have a potential juror, Mr. Snyder, removed for cause. The plaintiff had to use his final peremptory challenge in order to keep Mr. Snyder off the panel, and that meant that he had to take another undesirable juror onto the panel. Ultimately, in addressing whether the trial court's failure to strike Mr. Snyder was reversible error, the Texas Supreme Court held that harm is presumed in the case of a juror seating issue. And this is what they said, I'm quoting, "No one except the jurors themselves knows exactly what transpires in the jury room. We know only the verdict. Here we do not know why veneer member 7 was objectionable. But as in Castile, we cannot know for certain that his inclusion did not affect the verdict, so we presume harm." Same situation here. Just as a party has a right to exercise a peremptory challenge, here BNSF had a right to a jury shuffle under Rule 223. Just as a party who is exercising peremptory challenges is not required to provide its reasoning for exercising the peremptory challenge in the way that it is, Rule 223 does not impose any sort of a requirement that a party demanding a shuffle make any sort of explanation as to why that shuffle is being demanded. And just as the court in Cortez could not know what effect the objectionable juror would have had on the verdict, we cannot know.
Well, aren't they going to argue in Cortez there was an objectionable juror on the panel, and you had the opportunity to prove that you were required to take an objectionable juror because you didn't get your shuffle, but you didn't do that. Isn't that how they're going to distinguish these two cases?
They may try to do that, but that really doesn't hold up, Your Honor, in my opinion, because there was no reasoning given for why this person was objectionable. They accepted the representation that it was an objectionable juror without getting into the reasonings for why that would be. And here, we have a right, just as they have a right in Cortez to exercise peremptory challenges, we have a right to the shuffle. We can't know what effect there is from the fact that we didn't get a shuffle and that the jury was seated in the way it was instead of letting us exercise our right to that shuffle. And the inability to determine what effect that has on the verdict under Castile means that we should presume harm. In arguing against the presumed harm standard, there are a lot of arguments that have been made. One of the cases that Ms. Whipp's lawyers rely upon is the Jackson case, which is a 2011 opinion from the Houston Court of Appeals, the first Court of Appeals. And in that particular, I see my time's running out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel, please.
May it please the court, I'm John Tavermina, and this is Scotty McLean, and we're representing appellee Ms. Whipp. And I'd like to start, if I can, on the Jackson case, where counsel left off, and talk a little bit about that, and she could respond if she chooses when she stands up. Jackson is a case from the Court of Appeals in Houston. It is really identical to our situation. In fact, what happened in Jackson was the trial court, for some unexplained reason, probably wasn't in a good mood that morning, he told the lawyers, I'm going to give you, here are the jury cards. I'm going to give you 15 minutes to look at the jury cards. Then we're going to pick a jury. And if any of you ask for a shuffle, it'll be denied. So they looked at the jury cards, and of course, one of the counsel requested a shuffle. The judge promptly denied the shuffle. Went up on to the Court of Appeals with the issue that it was improperly denied because it should have mandatorily been granted under Rule 223. And the Court of Appeals first said, you know, we're not even going to rule that that was error. We're not going to rule that the judge committed error by denying that shuffle. But for purposes of our opinion, we'll presume it was error. And then we'll go on from there. So they presumed the denial of the shuffle was error without making that ruling. Then they went on to basically take all of the points in counsel's brief and they lay it out in the opinion and show why the case should not have been reversed. First, they deal with Cortez very specifically, and they say, in Cortez, you had a specific objectionable juror. You don't have that here. They also dealt with the Rivas case, which is another Texas Supreme Court case. There is not one jury shuffle case in Texas that applies the presumed harm standard. The only standard applies is the harmless error rule. When you look at what happened with respect, I'm sorry, I have a nosebleed.
Very sorry. It's okay.
Counsel, would you like a recess?
If you don't mind, Your Honor, I am so sorry.
Okay, why don't we stand at recess for 10 minutes or however long it takes for the nosebleed, if it takes longer.
Thank you.
about the Houston Court of Appeals case, and I did quote it extensively in our brief because it really does address, I think, all of the issues that were raised by the appellant. The court, first it dealt with Rivas and talked about you have to have some evidence of a lack of randomness, and they found that there was no such evidence there. The court also said that the harmless error rule applies. And in talking about Cortez, they made the specific distinction that in Cortez, a proper objection was laid to a juror to be stricken for cause. That juror wound up on the jury, and that's where the court said, the Supreme Court of Texas, we don't know what kind of influence that juror specifically had. But there was no such situation there in the Jackson case. Counsel, in their reply, talked about the dissent in Jackson, and I'd actually like to talk about that a little bit, because the dissent was written by Justice Sharp in Houston. And if you read that dissent, Justice Sharp actually says Rivas does stand for the proposition that you need to have more than just an argument that maybe a shuffle would have changed the actual makeup of the jury. Because in Jackson, the plaintiff actually tried to make a record. The plaintiff said that there were two jurors that she wished she could have stricken, but she couldn't because they were in the first part of the panel. And she also tried to make a record that some of the jurors that were beyond the 24th juror were good jurors for her and may have been able to get on the panel. So if you look at that dissent that's relied upon, that judge also agrees that you have to show something more, something to say there wasn't a randomness to the panel. That justice actually said, I disagree with, but I know that all Texas law on this point uses harmless error. I don't understand why. He disagrees with that fact. But the fact is, as of today, Rivas and all of the cases that deal with this issue deal with harmless error. That's what it is. And the Texas Supreme Court, there was a petition for review there, and the Texas Supreme Court denied review in that Jackson case. So the law that we have is Jackson and Rivas and Carr, and they're all on point saying that there is no evidence of a lack of randomness here. I'd also like to talk a little bit about the shuffle issue.
Before you leave that, Mr. Travamina?
Yes, sir.
How do you fit the term voir dire to mean reading from a card? I mean, voir dire by its strict meaning is an exchange of verbal discussion between a lawyer and a prospective juror.
Well, Judge, I've been doing this for 35 years, and I think that's the way it used to be. But now, and I'm not from here, but I've been able and lucky to try a whole lot of cases here in Tarrant County. And these jury questionnaires are a big part of our practice now.
Well, sir, now, I'm not arguing that. I've been trying cases before I came on the bench. I tried cases in Tarrant County for 42 years, and I know how the jury system works. I've been on the jury myself. I've answered the questions. I've been assigned to a court. I understand that all of that works. But there was no face-to-face exchange between any counsel in this case and the jurors until after the demand for a shuffle had been made in this case, as I read the record. And I don't know how you can get into what's on the cards. I know it's helpful information. I know it's a good starting place, and I applaud the additional information and quick information that's given to lawyers, because I've had a lot of times when I've been told you got 15 minutes to pick.
Yes, sir.
And so, but I still come back to the fact that you cannot have a voir dire examination until you start talking to the jury.
Well, and I respect that position that you have, but these questionnaires now, whether it's a question that's actually asked by a lawyer or one asked on a piece of paper. And the issue of whether the jury was sworn is a separate one. But on these questionnaires, and their exhibit, the questionnaire is exhibit one to our brief, both on page one and then on the final page where they signed it under the penalty of perjury, and they say, we're speaking the truth here, and that's what voir dire means, to speak the truth. And as a trial lawyer, we know once we get that information, a shuffle is supposed to be before you really know much at all but what's on the general cards, to ask for a shuffle. But if I read the information and I know that Susie Smith's had two back surgeries and my client had two back surgeries, and this one has a problem with railroads, because that's how specific the questionnaires were, and then I get to go in after reviewing that information and say, gee, I really need a shuffle. That is voir dire. That's what the lawyer would be getting, so much extra information. And I wish we had a better exact chronology of what happened. But to me, the issue is, on the Carr case and all these cases, did BNSF look at the information? If they truly wanted to have a jury shuffle, they're very honorable people. We would have trusted their affidavit. They should not have looked at the answers to the questionnaire. The judge gave everybody his email, the phone numbers, but even if they had said, we know what the law is, we're going to ask for a shuffle on Monday morning, so we can't look at those answers. But once they had all of that detailed information, there's 57 blanks for that juror, each juror to sign. Once they had that information and used it to come in and ask for a shuffle, that can't be what the shuffle's all about.
Let me ask you a hypothetical.
Yes, sir.
You've got the cards, you got the numbers on the cards, you got the 1 through 50, you know who the 1 through 50 is, you know how they're going to be seated in the courtroom.
Yes, sir.
And the first 5, 6, 7 jurors have got answers on their questionnaire, that would render them unacceptable, one side or the other, I don't care which side.
Yes, sir.
And then a shuffle is made. Isn't a shuffle nothing more than the luck of the draw, in the sense that you might get 10 people? The first 10 might be unacceptable to one side or another after the shuffle.
No one knows.
That's exactly right.
The shuffle could come up the exact same way for all
we
know.
So if you don't do the shuffle, I don't know how you know who would be bad.
Well, I don't think I made I probably wasn't clear. What I was saying, let's assume if I could take your hypothetical one step further.
Yes, sir.
What if by looking at the jury questionnaires and only by that detailed information, I, either as plaintiff or defendant, I realize, now I have all this extra information, and I realize that the first 5 jurors are bad for me. I'm going to ask for the shuffle based on that, not just based on the general information that I'm allowed to get before asking for a shuffle. That's what.
No, I wonder if you can put an onus on either party that might have the burden of proof in the case by trying to hypothecate on what might happen in the shuffle that would give.
I think you're 100% right. We don't know what the result of any shuffle is going to be.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Okay. So the language of shall grant the request is just rendered meaningless. I mean, the shall means nothing.
Well, the shall probably means something, but the question is, once they review the detailed information on the questionnaire, has that exchange of information from the individual prospective jurors to the lawyer, has that begun the start of the voir dire?
But if the rule says voir dire doesn't start until the admonitory instructions are given, and that a shuffle request prior to that shall be granted, isn't that basic law school mandatory? The trial court has to grant it, shall?
I think you can make that argument, Your Honor. but the reality of the way we pick juries now and the way it's the same way in Harris County. The questionnaires are given in the General Assembly room, and the oaths are given there, and then they come back. And the rules that I think most lawyers follow, and if you go to the seminars, they say, if you've looked at the questionnaires, the voir dire has begun. So you're right.
So the rules have to give way to the reality of how it actually happens.
Well, that would be my argument, Your Honor. Yes, ma'am. Before my time starts to run out, I'd like to talk a little bit about the damage award in this case and tell the court why I believe it should be upheld. The way the issue was submitted, both pain, future pain and suffering, and future mental anguish were included in one submission. We've cited cases in our brief which stand for the proposition that since they were not properly objected to, and the court was not given an opportunity either to take out one or both because of no evidence claims, or to separate them out, have one future pain, one for future mental anguish if a proper objection was made, then this court's analysis needs to be based on, is there enough evidence on either pain and future pain, either future mental anguish, or a combination of both? And we have gone through the facts in the brief, and I'm not going to repeat them, but I would like to focus a little bit on the Supreme Court case of Fifth Club versus Ramirez, because in that case, first, this appellate court has made many rulings on future pain, future mental anguish, and you know them better than I. We've cited a bunch of them. And it is very hard to quantify. It's a matter best left up to the jury in the case based on the evidence that that jury has heard. What is mental anguish? There are a million definitions of what it is. But in Fifth Club versus Ramirez, one key test is, was there a substantial disruption in plaintiff's daily routine? And this young woman, made it in a man's profession. A very limited amount of conductors out there countrywide are women. She started from the bottom. The conductor's the head of these railroad crews. She got there. She was making a lot of money. She was independent. She did whatever she wanted to do. She had no back problems. And then a man that should never have been working tried to throw her from a moving train by the way he operated the train. And we were criticized in our brief for setting forth the egregious acts of that man and the railroad. But the jury gets told and asked, if you found negligence, which they found against the railroad, state the damages, if any, that arose from the occurrence in question. The occurrence in question and what happened to this young woman is totally relevant to the damages she suffers today. She's not independent at all anymore. She can't do any of the things she used to do. She's got significant physical limitations every single day of her life. She can't go out there and work on trains and climb up and down those ladders and hang on the side of the trains, a job she loved to do. Now she's limited to a sedentary job where her employer is going to have to let her stand up a whole lot because she can't even sit down that long. That is if that's not mental anguish, we as potential jurors, the people that judged this case, had to look at her and say, what is she going to look forward to? What's going to happen compared to what she was before the accident? And her life is totally different now. She can't do any of the things that she had to do. And as regular people, when we talk to our friends, the egregious nature of how you got hurt, you got run over by a drunk driver, you know, that's part of the mental anguish. She didn't do anything wrong. She went to work like we all do every day. In a job she had grown up and become one of the best performers out there, the pride that goes along with that. They took all that away from her. And to say she doesn't have pain when she's still on three medications. She hasn't slept for more than 3 hours on any one night since this accident happened. It affected the relationship with her children, and I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Now we have a rebuttal from Ms. Ault.
Justice Meyer, I'm going to begin with your comment that voir dire can't begin until you start talking to jurors. I agree with that. Beyond that, in this case, the lawyers had not even had the opportunity to see the jurors, much less see the jurors in their seated order. And Justice Gabriel, they had not been given the instructions that the rules require. We simply cannot have a system in which the practices of the parties overtake the rules and what they require. That cannot and should not happen. There's no reason in this case or in any other that we cannot preserve the right to demand a jury shuffle and get the benefit from using juror questionnaires. That can happen in a situation like we had in this particular case. While the jurors were in the central jury room filling out the cards, lawyers could have been told they have an opportunity to look at the cards and see the jurors in their seated order and have the opportunity at that period of time to request a shuffle or not before the questionnaires ever even came into play. There is a way that we can use all of the different tools and still follow the rules the way that the Supreme Court intended for them to be applied when the rules of civil procedure were drafted. In Jackson, the Court of Appeals majority simply got it wrong. In the dissent, I appreciate Mr. Tavermina's characterization of the dissent, but I respectfully disagree. The dissenting justice said so many things. Don't want to read a lot from it, but this is particularly apt. To require a litigant to demonstrate harm under such circumstances places the litigant in an impossible position. How can a litigant prove that a jury is more or less random based on a shuffle that never happened? This analysis leads to a chain of speculation about the possible composition of the jury and the harm suffered, on and on. There's no way when a shuffle has been denied for there to be a showing of harm. In Carr, it was erroneously, according to the court, granted. So we had the previous shuffle and then another shuffle we could compare. When it has been denied, there is nothing to compare it to. And to suggest that you could somehow come in that setting and demonstrate the lack of randomness when you have nothing to compare it against, that's an impossible burden to place on the litigants. This case, I think, is the very reason that Rule 223 is written the way that it is by the Supreme Court. A party can make one shuffle demand as a matter of right. The court has to do it. We don't have to talk about what the reasons are, don't have to justify it, don't have to show randomness, lack of randomness, harm, relaxed harm, presumed harm, nothing. You get one shot at it, and that's it. The way that the rules are written, there aren't many times when we give courts a mandatory rule. Most of the time when we're talking about the conduct of trial, there's a lot of discretion. Here there is none, and the reason is clear. We want the court to do what has to be done without involving all of the showings that now Ms. Whip's counsel is telling us have to be made here. Compare this to Rule 544, a jury demand. I make a demand, I pay the fee, the court shall set it as a jury trial. If you don't, can we imagine that anyone would come in and say, well, the trial court had the discretion not to give a jury trial? That you had to show harm because of the failure to give a jury trial? No. It's a mandatory rule, shall and a demand. That's exactly what we have here. With respect to the damages, mental anguish, future physical pain, adequate showing was not made. This is not a Fifth Club versus Ramirez case. This is not, as unfortunate as the injuries are, that kind of a shocking and disturbing incident. And there we were only dealing with $20,000, not $1 million in future mental anguish. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to thank, on behalf of the court, all of the lawyers for excellent presentations. Your case is submitted, and you are excused.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We will.